C.S. Lewis, he once used this analogy. He said, imagine you visited a foreign country. You visited a foreign culture, and somebody was there kind of taking you around the city, the place, and they wanted to take you to a theater one night. So they take you to this theater, right? And then everybody's kind of abuzz, like everybody's excited about the show that's going to start. And then the lights come down and everybody kind of scrambles to get to their seats and they're really excited. And a guy walks up on stage and he's holding a platter, right? Like a serving platter. And there's a lid on the platter. And the lights are down and the spotlight goes up on the guy with the platter. And he begins to slowly lift the lid off of the platter, and as he's lifting the lid off the platter, everybody's oohing and aahing, and they're at the edge of their seats, right? They're looking forward for more, and he lifts the lid off, and it reveals a sizzling, juicy, tender, medium rare steak, because Christians eat steak medium rare, right? And steam's coming off of it, and it's a legit filet, okay? Like grass-fed, you know, Delfrid, it's just a legit filet. And everybody just stands, and man, they're just applauding. And the lid goes on the platter, the spotlight goes down, the lights come up, the show is over, and everybody is like, oh man, that was amazing. That was amazing. He said, what conclusion must you come to after seeing something like that? He said, if you were a part of a foreign culture, a foreign country, and you saw that take place, the only conclusion that you could come to is that they must be starving. And for the hyper-sexualized culture that we're in, right, with the way in which the media is, TV and movies, with the spread of pornography, with this kind of unrestrained sexual freedom that we demand, right, with the hookup culture on college campuses and hookup apps like Tinder, with all of that, right, with this kind of fleeing from traditional Christian sex ethics, even by Christians in our churches, for all that that must be telling us, if we were to look at the culture right now, for all that it's saying, we could only come to one conclusion, that when it comes to intimacy, we're starving. That we're starving. That we're starving for love, we're starving for connection, we're hungry for intimacy, closeness, we want covenant. We want deep, a deep bond of love. That we're starving, that we're hungry for that. That's what we're looking for. And you don't have to be a Christian or agree with Christian sexual ethics to realize that there is brokenness around us, that we're hungry. You don't have to be a Christian to believe that. You don't have to be a Christian in here to have walked through what most of us have walked through. Like Christian or non-Christian alike, in this place, most of us have experienced some sort of sexual brokenness, yes? Right? Most of us in here have experienced some sort of betrayal or relationship that went bad, or the guilt perhaps of sexual sin. We've experienced pornography, or maybe it was sexual abuse. There's not very many of us in here that probably haven't experienced sexual brokenness. At the least, it's around us, and you don't have to believe the Bible to believe that that's true. And so when you look at that, you look at us, and you look at culture, what you have to come to is that we are starving. That we're starving for intimacy, and we're starving for love. That's why we took up the Song of Songs back in January. Took it up because we said, man, we need healing in this. We need instruction in these matters of romance and sex and marriage and dating and things like that. We need to learn. We need to grow. We need to have some understanding. And so what we've learned along the way is really kind of two running themes, two things that keep coming up as we talk about this. One is just that sex is a great gift of God, right? Like a passionate, even erotic gift from God for marriage. That's what we've seen. But then the second thing that we've seen is also that it's not everything, right? That marriage and sex is not everything, that it will not, it cannot fulfill, it cannot satisfy, that ultimately it is a glimpse, it's merely a taste, it's a preview of coming attractions. that love and marriage and sex will always disappoint you if you think that it's meant to satisfy you. That actually it's a song that's being sung about God's love for us. That it's just a taste of something better, of something bigger, of something that will satisfy. We've seen those two themes running together, right? Sex is great, it's a gift, it's good, but it is not everything. It points to everything, but it is not everything. And so this is a song, and it's a song about biblical love, and we've been wanting to hear it sing. And it sings about God's love for us. Now, if you remember, it's a song, and the lead actor, the lead singer, is the gal, right? She sings the most. She sings, she's most passionate. She's most comfortable, it seems, in her sexuality as she sings to her husband. And so she's singing, but who is she singing to? Well, she's singing to her single friends. It's a song about marital love, but she sings to these daughters of Jerusalem, right? They show up three times, they show up many times in the song, but three times she sings this chorus to them. Do not arise or awaken love until it pleases. Until it's time, don't awaken this great marital gift of sexual love, sexual intimacy that God has given to us. And so this morning, she's not going to sing to her single friends. This morning, she is single. Right? This morning, it goes back to, the song ends with her as a young single gal. And there's going to be two themes this morning in our text, purity and passion. Right? Purity and passion. Or you could argue that it's one theme, purity that leads to passion. Okay? So here's what I want to do this morning. I want to answer some questions for you that you've probably been asking all along, especially some of you that are unmarried, as you've had to sit through now like 8 weeks of, you know, us talking about sex and saying you can't do that, right? So you've got some questions. You're welcome for that. You have some questions. I've been waiting to answer them till this week in this text, okay? So here it is. So I'm going to answer some of your questions. And then for all of us, I want us to look at the hope that we have in Jesus, okay? Because look at me. The hope that we have in Jesus for all of us, because this, if we are hungry, right? If we have tasted of all that creation has for us, if we have feasted on all that the world provides, right? Money, sex, relationship, love, right? All that you've eaten of already, and if it hasn't satisfied, then just maybe you were made for a different kind of food. Just maybe you were made for divine love. Just maybe you were made for infinite joy. And so we all need to hear of the hope that we have in Jesus. Okay? So I'm going to answer some questions. We're going to talk about Jesus, and then we'll be done. All right, so Song of Songs, chapter 8. Look at verse 8. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. Then I was in his eyes and as one who finds peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal-Hamon. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. But my vineyard, my very own, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have the 1,000 and the keepers of the fruit 200. So here's what's happening. In verse 8, either her brothers are singing to us, or what's more likely, she's singing about how her brothers approached her in her singleness in regards to defending and protecting her sexuality, okay? Right, in ancient cultures, it was the brother's responsibility to protect their sisters from the guys, right? From the suitors. And of course, most of, the culture is still very much like that. Right? I did that for my sister. I can this will be hard for some of you guys because you know me as kind and gregarious and amiable and just such a sweet guy. But back in the day, I was a little bit more intense and more gruff. And so this one time, a boy calls my sister. She's maybe 16, 17 years old. And it was like 9 o'clock at night. So like not quite too late, but kind of late, right? And so I'm 18 or 19 or however old I am. And I answer the phone, which was bad for him. And he said, you know, may I speak with Samantha, my sister? And I said, what time is it at your house? He's like, it's almost 9 o'clock. I said, yeah, it's 9 o'clock here too. Never call this late again. My sister, when we were growing up, she came to me, she's like, you know, you realize all of my boyfriends were afraid of you. And I said, that was the point. Right? That was the whole point, right? That's what her brothers are doing here, right? If she is a wall, right? I think the imagery is clear here. If she's a wall, that means she's impenetrable, right? That means she's going to remain chaste, that she's going to be pure, and the picture of the door is clear as well. That means she's going to let guys in. And so the brothers say, well, if she is a wall, then what we're going to do is we're going to build a battlement of silver. And we don't know exactly what that means, probably something to do with honoring her, right? If she's a wall, then we're going to honor her in that. But what's really clear is what they mean if she is a door. If she is a door, they're going to put a cedar fence around her, right? They're going to fence her in. Just imagine like three brothers on the front porch with shotguns. Ain't nobody getting in the door, right? Nobody's getting in the door today. Door's locked, you know. We're done here. And so that's what's happening here. Now, a young woman's purity isn't more important than a young man's. There's no double standards in the Bible. Just because we're talking about the gal here doesn't mean that the guys in the Bible get off the hook, because this is a song. The gal is the primary singer of the song, and so the focus has been on her and her sexuality, and so it's focused here on her purity. But the rest of the Bible talks about men's purity as well. I'll give you a couple of examples. Psalm 119, verse 9. You want to know how to do this, guys? How can a young man keep his way pure? Here's the answer. By guarding it according to your word. And I'm going to put God's word in my heart, and it's going to be like a cedar fence around my sexuality, around my purity, okay? And then you got 1 Timothy 5:2, that the men in the church are to treat younger women as sisters in all purity. The Bible is calling you men to treat the gals in this church as your sister in all purity. Okay, so then in verse 10, she says, I was a wall. Right? So kind of moves back to present tense. She's singing. She says, I was a wall. And now she's mature. She's become a woman. And she says, I was in his eyes as one who finds peace. Okay, and so she's saying, I because of my purity, I can give my husband peace. And then in verse 11, there's a play on that word peace when she talks about Solomon. Solomon had a vineyard. Solomon's name means peace. And so she's saying, in my purity, I gave my husband peace. Solomon had a vineyard, but he wasn't able to give peace, right? The vineyard in the song has been imagery for what the whole time? Sex, right? Sex. And so Solomon, he gave his vineyard to pretty much anybody, right? If you just kind of follow the metaphor there. But then in verse 12, she says, but my vineyard, right? My sexuality, my very own, it's before me. I've kept it. I've kept it. Remember, Solomon wrote this song. He wrote this song. He knows the pains of walking away from God's commands, especially in regards to sex. He had 1,000 wives and girlfriends, and they led his heart astray. They led his heart away from the Lord. He understands the pain, and so he writes this imagery into the song where he's given his vineyard away, but she hasn't hers, that she's able to give her husband peace. There's purity in her life, and she has stayed pure. And so this gives us a chance to talk about something that I've wanted to talk about and to answer questions that we keep getting and that we always get. And it's this question, why does Christianity teach that sex before marriage is wrong? Okay, or some form of that question, because what Christians will ask, well, they'll recognize that as just being a reality. What Christians will ask is, well, then how far is too far? I can't have sex. Okay, so you know, what can I do? Where's the line? I won't cross it. I mean, I might cross it a couple of times, but not really a big deal. But I'm going to try not to cross it. I just want to know where the line is. Where's the line to where where do I go? We always have these questions, right? We love do's and don'ts because we want to know where it is. We want to know how far we can go. Right? That's our hope. How far can I go before I get in trouble for this? You know, you're like, oh, pastor, you know, I should be a wall. Okay, what kind of wall? Right, what kind of wall am I supposed to be? There's climbing walls. You know, there's the Great Wall of China. Trump wants to build a wall. I mean, I don't know. What kind of wall do you want me to be? What kind of wall should I be? And so we have these kinds of questions. And what I love about how the song has answered this question is it shows us the glories of sex, right? It shows us the beauties of sex. It shows you this great gift that it is. And then it says, hey, so then don't arise or awaken love until it pleases. Let's not mess this up. Right, this is a gift from marriage. Look how great it is. Let's not mess this up. I love that because it tries to motivate your obedience by showing you the joy, right? By showing you the joy. Here's what a great gift it is. Now be obedient to God. And so G.K. Chesterton, he once said this. This is a good warning for us, and it gives us a chance to talk. He says this. G.K. Chesterton, he says, don't ever take down a fence until you know why it was put up in the first place. Don't ever take down a fence until you know why it was put up in the first place. And so let's chat about that. Right? Let's chat about the fence. Let's chat about the wall that this gal chose to be. Okay? And before we let the influence from an intimacy-starved culture lead us away from traditional sex ethics, and before we just throw that out and just walk with the way in which the world would do this and believe its story, I think God has a better story. Let's figure out why the fence was put up in the first place, okay? So let's talk. What we've tried to show throughout this whole book and what I think we've talked about is that sex is a great gift, but it's a great gift for the safe and secure place of marriage. That sex is unbelievably powerful. It is not safe. That is absolutely powerful, and it's a great thing in the context of marriage. And the reason why is because you don't just have sex with your body. Sex is the holy giving of yourself to another in every which way, body, mind, soul, spirit, right? You give yourself physically, mentally, emotionally, relationally, spiritually, giving yourself to another. And you don't need to be a Christian to believe that, right? Science proves that's true. Science proves, neuroscience will say that there's a bonding effect. There's a uniting effect hormonally when you're having sex, that it's actually, hormones gluing you two together, and you may not want to be glued to this person. What keeps boyfriends and girlfriends in a bad relationship is sex. And it's because, like, I know this because either we've experienced it or we knew that friend, right? We had that friend where it was like, why are you with this guy or why are you with this girl? And you're pleading with them and they won't do what seems obvious. Why? I almost guarantee it's because they're having sex. It's bonding, it's uniting, it's gluing them together. Right? Sex is powerful. Literally, it creates, right? It's the only thing that humanity can do to create life. You think it's a small thing? That's a big, powerful deal, and it is uniting. And so I don't actually need chapter and verse to show you why sex before marriage is wrong. Everything the Bible teaches about sex and everything it teaches about marriage will prove that sex before marriage or sex outside of marriage is wrong. But I have one for you anyways, so you're welcome. I've got like dozens of them actually, but I'll just give you one. I'll give you chapter and verse because you just asked me to it. So 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I'll show this to you. We'll spend a few moments here, and then I'll hopefully you'll be happy. 1 Corinthians 6, it says this. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? Why? Well, because for it is written, the two will become one flesh. That's how God designed it. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. You're united to Jesus now. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own. How countercultural is that? You are not your own. Great reason why, though, for you were bought with a price. How valuable you are. How valuable you are. And so glorify God in your body. Okay, so this text confirms what we've been saying all along, that, sex is uniting, right? It's binding. And it says, hey, you're united to Jesus. If you're a Christian, you've been united to God in Christ, right? You're united to Jesus. You're one with Jesus. And he says, and so if you have sex with a prostitute, you become one with her. How can you do that? How can you do that? You're one with Jesus. Why would you become one with a prostitute? No, they're literally sleeping with prostitutes. There was men in this Christian in the Corinthian church that were sleeping with prostitutes. It was part of the pagan worship in that culture, okay? So you think our culture is sexualized. Part of worship in that culture was to go sleep with temple prostitutes. There was 1,000 of them. And so literally they're doing that. But what Paul is saying is what we've been saying all along, and that's that sex is not just a normal bodily function. No matter what the world says, it's not the same thing as brushing your teeth and going to the bathroom. It's a little bit bigger deal than that. It's a little bit more power to it than just that. And so verse 18 then says, flee sexual immorality, right? Run from it then. Sprint, stay as far away. Don't come close to the line. Stay as far away as you can from sexual sin, from sexual immorality. Why? Because sex is wrong? Because it's bad? Because God doesn't want you to have fun? Is that why the command is there? No, the Song of Songs, what does it say? Man, this is great, this is beautiful, this is wonderful, but don't arise or awaken love until it pleases. Let's not mess this thing up. Flee sexual morality because it's bad? No, because it's amazing. Because it's amazing, because it's a great gift. And we don't want to take a good gift from God and screw it up. Right? We can take good things from God and make them bad things, yes? Breakfast tacos are from heaven. Right? Manna from heaven, tortillas, eggs, cheese, brisket, right? It's from heaven, but you know what? If you have 20 of them, it's not good. If you have 20 of them every day, you're going to become obese, you're going to get heart disease, you will die. You will die from breakfast tacos. We can take blessings from God and make them curses. We can take the good gift of sex and it can bring immense pain. Immense pain, right? So we flee from sexual immorality, right? We run from sexual immorality. And then it's the word sexual morality that helps us. This is your chapter and verse, okay? Flee sexual morality. That's the word porneia. In the original language, it's porneia. It's where we get the word pornography from. And what porneia means is any sort of sex outside of marriage. It's a junk drawer term for anything, any sort of sexual activity outside of marriage. And so this becomes then, flee sexual morality. This becomes our chapter and verse. It answers the how far is too far question. Run from it. Run from it. Flee sexual morality, right? This means there's no intercourse, right? There's no intercourse. That means there's no outer course, okay? This means there's no coursing at all. There is no courses before marriage. There are no courses until you get married, right? Some people ask, well, can my boyfriend spoon me? No, he cannot spoon you. There's no spooning. Okay, there's no spooning, there's no forking, there's no knifing, you can't even go into the kitchen until you're married. And then when you're married, you can go to the kitchen all you want. But there's no cutlery at all and no courses before you get married, right? Flee sexual morality. How far is too far? There is no far. There's no line. There's no line to cross. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Why? Because sex is bad? No, because it's great. It's great. And when you get married, do whatever you want. It's great. It's great. But before then, no, nothing. Run from it. Flee it. You're bought with it. You know how valuable you are. You know how valuable you are. Your worth, God's love, leads him to this command that says, hey, I want for your joy. Obey me. Obey me. I want for your joy. Obey me. This is for your good. And listen, being a wall, fighting for purity before marriage, it doesn't restrict your desires or your passions. It's not going to hinder you from those things. It enhances your desires and your passions. Look at verse 13. He sings to her. This is it. This is the end of the song. Oh, you who dwell in the gardens with companions listening for your voice, let me hear it. He invites her, right? He calls for her. She says, make haste, my beloved. Right? Let's do this fast, man. Come quickly. Be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. Right? Her passion is all the more. She invites him to intimacy, right? She invites him to her mountains of spices. I shouldn't by now, at the end of the song, have to explain to you what that means. She invites him to intimacy, to be with her. Right? There's passion and there's erotic fire in the way in which this song ends, just like it began. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Come and be on my mountains of spices, right? There is fire here still. Purity has led to it. It has enhanced the passion that she has for her husband and his passion and desire for her. I've said this a couple of weeks ago, but I think it bears repeating, as this song has sung to us this gift of marriage and at the same time warned us to not arise or awaken this kind of love, this erotic love, until it pleases, until it is the right time. What I said a couple of weeks ago was this: if obedience to God and sex ends up like this, this kind of joy, this kind of passion, this beauty, this gift, if obedience to God in regards to sex leads to this kind of joy, might we finally realize that obedience to God in all of life leads to our joy? This is just fire, man. This is passion that this couple has for each other. Does anybody feel like they're being robbed of anything as you've read this song? No, there's freedom and beauty in their intimacy and in their relationship. But here's what's interesting. The song, it just seems to abruptly end. The song just kind of seems to stop. In fact, even while there's passions and desires still, and those desires are fueled, they're not consummated at the end. You see passions, but passions unquenched. That it ends with anticipation, it ends with longing, it ends with the desire. It doesn't end with the desire being met. That the song actually ends like all relationships and all love ends. Right? The song ends with love unfulfilled. The song ends with desires being unmet. In fact, it's the perfect ending. Because what it does is it affirms our passions and our desires. It affirms those things as right and good and godly. But at the same time, it leaves those passions unfulfilled because it is unfulfilling. It leaves us unsatisfied because love and sex and marriage is unsatisfying. That it actually doesn't fulfill and it won't satisfy. That marriage and sex aren't everything. And so the song ends exactly how the Bible ends. The song ends with us wanting more, waiting for more, waiting for some kind of love to fulfill us. The Bible ends in the same way, waiting for restoration, waiting for Jesus to come back and make all things new. And so the song ends like the Bible ends, like love ends, waiting for something that's bigger, waiting for something that's better. It is just a shadow. The best marriage and the best sex will leave us wanting more. This is hard for our generation. This is hard for our culture. Everyone that lives on the earth right now, especially in the West, especially in America, this is a hard truth for us to swallow, that we have to wait, that we can't be fulfilled. Because everything in our culture now is immediate gratification. Everything. We've got notifications on our phone, we've got likes and hearts, and we've got desires that we have that want to be met, and so we meet them immediately. Immediately. You want to watch a TV show? You watch whatever show you want. You watch it right now. In my day, you had to wait till like Thursday at 9 o'clock to watch it. Now you just watch whenever. Right? You want to eat something, you go out and get it and you eat it. There are endless options before you. We want something, we want it right now, but that's not real life, or at least that's not the real stuff of life. The real stuff of life is waiting. In the real stuff of life, there is anticipation. There's disappointment in the real stuff of life, especially if we put too much weight on it and think that it will fulfill us or that it will somehow satisfy us. We don't like this at all. So the song ends, but it doesn't really end. It leaves us wanting more. But the song ends because love has not ended. God's love for you has not ended. So the song of love, the song of songs, does not end. God's not done loving you yet, and so the song still sings. God's not done with you yet. Do you realize that? Because here's what I can imagine the question has to be for a lot of us. What do we do now? What do we do if we're not a wall? What do we do if we have been a door? What do we do? What do we do if in a series on the great gift of sex and sexual purity over the last 3 months, even in the last 3 months, we've fallen again into sexual sin? What do we do now? What do we do if it happened last night? What do we do? We can't do what many in the church are doing. We can't just disregard this part of the Bible. We can't disregard what God says about sex, his commands on sex. We can't do that. Many in the church are doing that, right? I'll talk about God's love. We'll keep God, keep some of these parts, but not those parts, right? That's old. That's traditional. We got to bring the Bible into the 21st century. God is love, and I can do whatever I want. Can't do that. Can't do that. Not if you actually love Jesus. Not if you actually know and love Jesus. We can't do that, right? If you love Jesus, you can't do whatever the hell you want. You realize that, right? You know that, right? Yeah. What other relationship, loving relationship in the world, can you just do whatever you want in? There's no relationship you have that has any sort of meaning where you can do whatever you want. So why would we think that in a relationship with God, the God of the universe who loves us, why do we think we can do whatever we want? No, so what do we do? And here's the thing, man. The last 3 months, brothers and sisters that you have, men and women in this church, men and women in this room right now, who have same-sex attraction, over the last 3 months have sat in these sermons and heard these things and have, by God's grace, sought to honor God with their sexuality. And maybe they've fallen before. Maybe they've fallen during this series, just like some of you have. Maybe they've fallen into those desires, but they fight like hell by the power of the Spirit and by the grace of God to be obedient to God in their desires. And if you and I, who have different desires, take our sin lightly, do you know what that tells them? Do you know you're telling your brothers and sisters in this church who are having to do that because, you know, in our culture, that sin is worse than ours? Do you know what you're telling them? When you cross the line and it's no big deal, when you don't fight your sin with the same vigilance that they fight theirs, you tell them that their sin is worse than yours. That they really needed Jesus on the cross. You just kind of did. When you don't fight your sexual sin with the same ferocity that a same-sex attracted man or woman has to fight it in the church, you know how hard it is to be a Christian and have same-sex desires? And not because of Jesus, because of the church. And not because we won't welcome them. In this church, we do. But if you are light with your sexual sin, while they have to be ferocious with theirs, you are silently communicating to them that they're different. that their sin is worse. And that's just not true. God hung his son on a tree for your sin just as much as theirs. You need infinite grace and loving mercy just like they do. This is a big deal, man. So what do we do? What do we do if we were not a wall, but we were a door? What if you were a door last night? What do we do? Well, we do what every Christian does when we sin. See, the cross of Christ is God's love song to us. The cross of Christ is where the judgment for your sin and the loving mercy of God meet. The cross of Christ is God's love song. It's where justice and mercy kiss. And so whatever Christian does, and any sin that they have, whatever that sin is we take one look at that sin and 10 looks at Jesus. We take one look at our sin, then we take 10 looks at Jesus. We look at the cross, we listen and hear that the song of God's love still sings to us. God's love for us has not ended. God is not done with you yet. The song still sings. And so we listen for it, we hear it, we pick ourselves up, and we go, and we sin no more.